in Curtis Dabney versus Ron Stubbs.
And please the court, Mr. John H. Seal will present argument for petition.
May it please the court, this lawsuit results from a race between two cars on Highway 96 through the town of Lumberton near Beaumont. As a result of this, one car lost control, left the highway, and went into a house. Fortunately, there was no one in the house. The passengers in that car included a woman who was killed and two men who were injured. I represent the two injured men and the husband of the injured woman. There was no contact between the two vehicles. The evidence indicated, I think, beyond any question that the two automobiles were racing. There was evidence from occupants of the vehicle. There was also evidence from an eyewitness. There was also evidence from the investigating officer. All of the evidence indicated that the two automobiles were going in excess of 80 miles an hour at the time when one of these automobiles lost control and went over into the house and this accident resulted. We brought suit against the originally, or we didn't bring suit, we settled the case against the driver of the vehicle that my clients were riding in for the policy limits. This driver was insured by Home Insurance Company. That policy also contained an uninsured motorist provision. We subsequently brought suit against the other driver, Stubbs, who was uninsured, and also brought a suit against Home Insurance Company under the uninsured motorist provisions of the policy which covered the automobile in which my people were riding. This case proceeded to trial, and the jury answered issues based on the comparative negligence statute assessing negligence at 50% to the driver of the automobile in which my people were riding, 30% to the other driver, 10% to the woman passenger in our car, and 5% to each of the men passengers. The trial court proceeded to render a judgment based on these findings of the jury after allowing credit for the previous payments that had been made, not the previous payments, but for the percentage that had been so found by the jury in accordance with the Clem Test versus Duke case. And the case was decided by this court within the last 2 or 3 weeks that put that issue, I think, to rest once and for all. The Court of Civil Appeals, or Court of Appeals, reversed the case on the single holding that there was no evidence of proximate cause on the part of the other driver. Our application for writ of error was based on the premise that this was in direct contradiction to the Parrott versus Garcia holding, which held not only that the two drivers could be considered participants to the race, but also a person who was marking off the finish line, as was true in the Parrott versus Garcia case. This, I think, would certainly apply also to other people who were found to have contributed to the race or participated in the race, as was the case with the jury finding with reference to the woman that was riding in the car that was killed in the accident. Now, Parrott versus Garcia was a summary judgment case that came out of the Beaumont court. That resulted from a drag race that took place in the town of Biden. Of course, at that time, this was prior to the comparative negligence provisions that we now have in Texas, and contributory negligence, of course, was a complete bar. The court in that case held that anybody that had participated in a race could not recover because he would be negligent per se as a result of the violation of the Texas statute against racing on the public highways, and further that certainly this would be proximate cause as a matter of law because it was not only a cause in fact, but certainly it was foreseeable that someone in the zone of danger would be injured or killed as a result of racing on the highway. Now, the Court of Appeals seemed to put some importance to the fact that the jury in this case found no in answer to a special issue which inquired as to whether or not the driver of the uninsured vehicle veered over toward the driver of our vehicle. And the jury answered no to that, but the jury answered yes to the question as to whether or not the driver of the uninsured motor vehicle was racing, and answered yes as to the question of whether or not the driver of the motor vehicle was operating at an excessive rate of speed. The Court of Appeals seemed to say that since there was no veering, that had not caused our driver to lose control. However, not only was there the evidence of the racing itself, there was evidence of the fact that the high rate of speed is the thing that caused our driver to lose control, and it was indeed the racing that had gotten our driver up to the rate of speed that he was going at the time that he did lose control. Again, in the Parrott versus Garcia case, the court found, or the court held, that it was not necessary to go to the issue of whether or not there was negligence involved in changing lanes in that car, in that case, because the participation in the race standing alone was enough to knock out the plaintiff in that case and prevent him from being able to recover under the then contributory negligence bar. So I think the idea of the veering is immaterial in view of the court's, in view of the jury's findings that there was participation in the race and there was speed. Again, the home insurance company and also apparently the court seemed to attach some significance to the fact that there was no contact between the two vehicles. I think that clearly there have been many, many cases down through the years that have held that certainly it's not necessary for there to be contact between two vehicles. A negligent torque feeder that causes a vehicle to go off the road, lose control, has been held liable many, many times. And I think that no further citation is necessary on that point. Certainly, in the case of Mackey versus State, which was a Court of Criminal Appeals case, which was cited with approval by Justice Greenhill in the Parrott versus Garcia case. Mackey versus State, Mackey was convicted of negligent homicide, and the conviction was upheld by the Court of Criminal Appeals, but the facts were that Mackey had no contact with the car in which the person was killed at all. Mackey was racing with another vehicle, and the other vehicle that Mackey was racing with hit another car head on and killed somebody in there, and Mackey was convicted of negligent homicide strictly because of the fact that he had participated in the race. So there certainly was no contact in that case. And again, this was cited by approval, with approval by this court in Parrott versus Garcia. So I think that under the holding of Parrott versus Garcia, the mere finding that the party was involved in the race would have been the end of it, and they would be responsible, as the court held in this case, even without any jury findings of proximate cause. However, we don't have to stop there because here we do have jury findings of proximate cause on the issue of the racing and of the excessive speed. So certainly we submit that, that on that point that the opinion or the decision of the Court of Appeals should be reversed and the judgment of the trial court should be upheld. Cross points were brought up after the grand writ by the respondent in this case, and I will touch briefly on these cross points that were brought up. First, there was a contention that the negligence of the driver, Fontenot, in our case, should be imputed to one of the plaintiffs in this case, who was Haynes, because of the fact that Haynes was the owner of the automobile. This was a theory of agency and or a joint venture that was urged by the insurance company in this case. Number one, there's no evidence of any pecuniary interest whatsoever, so I submit that the idea of joint venture goes out in view of the previous holdings of this court. Secondly, I contend that the law is that the mere presence of an owner in a vehicle being driven by someone else does not mean that the negligence will automatically be imputed. I think the presence of an owner merely presents a rebuttable presumption that the driver is driving for the benefit of or for the agency of the owner, and that this presumption certainly can be rebutted, and indeed it was in this case, where the evidence was that all of these people were on the way to a funeral of a friend of the deceased woman, as a matter of fact. And certainly nothing could be gained in a financial way by the owner of the vehicle in any way. Secondly, the point brought up that the negligence of the passenger should be added to the negligence of the driver. And if that ends up totaling more than the negligence of the other car, of the driver of the other car, then that should cut you out under comparative negligence. Of course, that just, we submit, is not the law of comparative negligence. And the whole idea of comparative negligence is to penalize a party for that party's negligence, but certainly not to add that party's negligence to someone else's negligence so as to defeat recovery. Finally, another point is brought up on the question that proper credit was not allowed, and again we get into the question of 2212A and the Clintex versus Butte holding, and one that has been upheld now by this court to again gave directly in point. Certainly, as was said by Justice Dye, I believe in the Clintex versus Butte case, a defendant certainly cannot be expected to have their cake and eat it too. In this case, it was collected that the question of the percentage of negligence would be submitted to the jury, that is, the negligence of the settling defendant, and indeed it was. If the jury had found, for example, that 90% of this accident was caused by the negligence of the settling defendant, then certainly the insurance company in this case would want a credit for the whole 90%, and not just the $10,000, for example, that they had paid under the death claim. That was not found by the jury, but only found to be 50%, so 50% is what they're entitled to. Now, another point is brought up that they should receive credit for PIP payments. Again, this has been decided specifically in the, it was decided in the old Westchester versus Tucker case at the time when it was medical pay involved, but certainly the same rule would apply where you're talking about PIP as where you're talking about medical pay, because the idea of the holding in the Tucker case was that an insurance company could not take credit for something that would have the result of reducing the uninsured motorist coverage below the minimum prescribed by statute, which of course is $10,000 per person. And when you try to give the credit for PIP, you would in effect knock that down to $7,500 if you gave $2,500 credits. Certainly submit that that cannot be done. Finally, the issue is brought up about the proper formula, whether or not the proper formula was applied. We submit that certainly it was. The negligence, the 10% or the 5% of the case maybe was taken off the top. We then took the 50% of the remainder, and that's what this defendant was held liable for. Of course, a defendant in such a situation is jointly and severally liable, and the 50% is all that they were entitled to any credit for, and judgment was rendered for the remaining 50% after having given credit for the comparative negligence deduction, and we submit that proper.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. David Burnson will present argument for a respondent.
May it please the court, David Burnson from Beaumont represent the respondent, Home Insurance Company. Basically, the facts of this lawsuit are as Mr. Steele has stated, with certain differences that I think that are important. Basically, this was and Home Insurance concedes that the two cars that were involved were racing, as found by the jury. They were driving at an excessive rate of speed, and from the evidence, both the driver of the uninsured vehicle and the driver of the vehicle that actually ran into the house, and probably the occupants, were all intoxicated. At least there was evidence to that extent. We filed several points of error as to the court's judgment. The first was based on no evidence of approximate cause. The evidence reflected from the testimony showed that there was an eyewitness to the accident who had followed the two vehicles down the road from a stop position, accelerating at a high rate of speed and slowing back down to a stop position and accelerating at a high rate of speed. And during that activity, there was seen a female leaning out the window of the rear end of the car, counting down or making a counting down motion while the vehicles were in a stop position, and then the cars would accelerate. The testimony by the plaintiffs seen from the record showed that their theory was that the uninsured motorist, while in the left-hand lane and the vehicle that eventually crashed into the house was in the right-hand lane, that the uninsured motorist vehicle crowded them or bumped them and knocked them off the road to where they made a movement totally to the right up across, I think, 300 feet into a house. The eyewitness testified that he had watched and was watching the accident, that at the time that the vehicle that crashed left the road, the uninsured motorist vehicle was up ahead quite a distance, in fact, had run that, won that race, and that the car that, the vehicle that crashed went from the right-hand lane across the left-hand lane, hit the median, or the median, and then went back across the road, I think 435 feet, up through three 8-inch pine trees, and then hit a house with such an impact that it buried it up to the rear door, causing the death of the female passenger that was counting down the race and causing injury to the occupants. The jury and the respondent, I think, believe that it is of significance that the jury found that there was no movement into that lane of traffic which forced the vehicle off the road, nor did they find any contact or impact. The investigating DPS officer that actually heard the crash and arrived at the scene investigated and found that the movement of the vehicle completely eliminated the theory of the plaintiff that the uninsured vehicle forced them off the road, because obviously the movement of the wrecked vehicle was first to the left across the lane of traffic and then back to the right across the highway. The briefs show that there is a standard for negligence per se in finding a proximate cause. I think that petitioner's response that this court in Parent v. Garcia, citing Mackey, states that if you're participating in a race that you should automatically find that that is approximate cause as a matter of law of the incident can be distinguished from this fact situation. And I think that the Mackey case that was cited was talking about the fact that anyone who participates in a race is probably negligent as a matter of law, but then you must, as the court knows and has written on many occasions, you need to go on and establish approximate cause. I think it's distinguished that our fact situation is distinguished from the Parrott case and from the Shaver-Mansell, I think that's how you pronounce the case, it's cited therein, is that the people that were involved in the accident were found as negligent as a matter of law, and that such was a approximate cause of the matter of law, were actually involved in the collision. They were actually involved in the collision of the vehicles that were racing or came in contact with them. And I think that that, as a matter of law, established it. But I think from the fact situations presented in this case is that you have a vehicle that was some distance down the highway and granted was driving at an excessive rate of speed, participating in a race and may have been intoxicated, in no way caused the car back down the highway to lose control, go across the lane and up the highway. It's the proximate cause or cause in fact of the person losing control of the car and then crashing into the house. And I think that it is distinguishable from the Parrott Garcia case, and we would ask that this court do that. I think in the in fact, all the cases that are cited by the petitioner, I believe, show that there was this contact element, other than the Mackey case, which was a criminal case, which I think was cited for the purpose of establishing violation of that standard is negligence per se. The other cross points that we brought forth would be that subsequent to, I think, the trial, this lawsuit was actually tried twice, but subsequent to the second trial, the Court of Appeals in Beaumont stated that that there was in a situation where occupants of a car, passengers in a car, enter a vehicle where the driver is either drunk, or after they get into the vehicle, they find that he is drunk or intoxicated, and then with a reasonable opportunity to leave, does not do so, that in the past, while it had been a complete bar to a lawsuit brought by a plaintiff, that the 2212A should apply. I think that there are some public policy reasons under a fact situation that we have in this case, specifically with regard to the young lady that was killed in the wreck, that she was really the only adult in this vehicle, that she had participated in actually getting these minors alcohol, had participated in this wreck and in the racing by actually counting them down, and in fact the jury had found had encouraged the racing. And we would ask that, and I know it's may or may not have been proposed before, but we would ask that, and we asked the Court of Appeals, who did not address the issue, that if the courts are going to deny the defendants in these drinking situations the right of a complete bar to a person who actually gets into a vehicle with an intoxicated person or remains in the vehicle, that they should be at least held accountable for that. And we would ask this court to, as a matter of public policy, with the drinking and that's going on the highway, to combine the negligence of the passenger who knowingly gets into a vehicle with an intoxicated driver, to combine the driver and that passenger, assuming an affirmative finding of the jury issue that person perceived and knew that the driver was intoxicated, or having once got into the vehicle, discovered that he was intoxicated and had the opportunity to leave but did not or chose not to do so, we would ask under public policy, with the alarming rate that everyone I'm sure is aware of the DWI and the problems with death on the highway, that if a person does that or is found to be drinking, that in comparing, use 2212A as a basis, but compare the negligence of the other party to the combined negligence of the driver and the passenger. And we would do that because I personally have tried several of these cases with people getting into cars with drivers, but everybody, or probably even the passenger being drunk, passed out in the car or whatever. And while the jury will look at the intoxicated driver and usually establish a percentage of negligence on that driver, and looking at the passenger, they're usually small percentages. And it seems to me that as a matter of public policy, to prevent people who entering the car either intoxicated themselves or drinking or getting in the car with a driver that is intoxicated knowingly, that there should be a public policy to prevent people in that class from recovering. And we would ask this court to...
Counsel, let me get some facts straight. Now, Fontenot was the driver of the car. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And he was 50% at fault.
Yes, sir.
And Dabney was in the car, and was he 10%?
She was, yes, sir. 10%.
All right, she was 10%. Now, who else was in this death car?
Goosby.
And what percent?
I believe he was 5%.
And who else?
Haynes.
And what percent?
5%. That should total 50, or should total 80.
All right, 50, 60, it totals 70.
Okay, 70, that's right, excuse me, 70, and then the uninsured motorist was 30.
The head note on this totals up 105% instead of 100%, the head note for the case.
Well, maybe I made a mistake.
Well, it's got Stubbs 30%, that's the defendant.
Yes, sir.
Fontenot, 50%.
Yes, sir.
And the three Fontenot passengers, 10, 5, and 10. That would have 75% total fault in the death car, plaintiff's car.
The Supreme Court Journal has one of the passengers at 10% where they're, both the passengers besides Mrs. Dabney were 5%.
Yes, sir.
All right.
If Fontenot is 50%, Dabney is 10%, Haynes is 5%, Goolsby is 5%, that totals 70%.
All right, then it does total 100%. Now, what you're arguing is that that all of the persons who were drunk or drinking in the death car should be treated as one party?
Generally, yes, sir. What I would say is that, say, take Dabney, for instance, is taking her call of action against Stubbs. I think that you ought to total hers, the 10%, and the driver, which she encouraged and actually gave liquor to, the 50%, total those two for a total of 60, and compare them against the other driver of 30. As to Goolsby.
Well, that would result, would it not, if you treat them as one and no recovery because it's in excess of 50%?
Yes. In this case, it would work that way.
Do you find any authority in other jurisdictions for doing that?
No, sir, I did not.
Counselor, the public policy you're asking us to espouse is to prevent drinking and driving, then why wouldn't you combine the negligence of the two drunken drivers and compare that to the passengers? Seemed to me like that has more of an effect on not driving while intoxicated than the proposal you made.
If I understand, you're saying combine the two percentages of the two
drunken drivers? You asked us to make a public policy stand to combat driving while intoxicated.
Yes.
So why not put it on the drivers, since they're the ones who are driving while intoxicated? Combine their negligence. Wouldn't that have more of a chilling effect on driving while intoxicated than passenger negligence on in with the driver?
Yes, sir, that would have an effect too. In this situation, you do have a person, the other driver happened to be intoxicated also. I'm talking about that, and that very well may be good for the public policy also. But in a situation, I'm talking about generally in a situation where a passenger actually encourages a minor in drinking and racing, and actually gets in a vehicle with a drunk driver, or a person that's intoxicated, that for purposes against the other defendants that they sue, that it ought to be combined as to those two people because they knowingly go in there and get in a vehicle, travel on the highways with a person that's intoxicated. If I've answered your question, I'm not sure that I have. I'm not trying to avoid it. I think that would also help public policy. I think that there's a cry throughout the community to eliminate and get the drunk drivers off the highway, people that are drinking in automobiles. And I think this would be one way to do it, especially if the person in this situation, where you've got the only adult in the car that's providing the minors with alcohol, is testimony in the case, and then gets in and encourages this boy to drive at a high rate of speed.
How old were these passengers?
There were 16.
How old was Fontenot?
I think he was 16.
How old was the two?
I think one, his uncle was 17, and the other boy, I think, was 15, if I'm not mistaken. It's somewhere in there, and it may be reversed. One, I think Fontenot was 16 at the time, or 17. No, I think it was 16. And she was the only adult. She was 21, and they found that she did not discourage the activity. In fact, she participated in the drag racing herself. But I think more back to the issue of what I ask this court to do is that in a limited situations where persons, passengers, have either been drinking themselves, but specifically where they get into a vehicle with a driver that's known to them to be intoxicated and had the opportunity to leave and did not do so, then you should combine the negligence of those people as compared to a third party or defendant that's been sued. And that's what we would ask, you know, under the public policy that I stated. I think that in the Dabney, we were speaking to, as to the dead girl, I think that there's even more reason to do it in her case because of the fact that she was an adult, the fact that they found that she was encouraging the race and actually participating in the race herself. As to the other defendants, we would adopt the same arguments, except for the fact that the jury did not find that that they were participating or had encouraged the racing. There is one case that I could find. It's a 1923 case, Everton, where there was some victim that said Mrs. Everton was a guest in the car of Mrs. Langford and could not be held responsible for the manner in which the car was operated unless she in some way encouraged the owner in violating the law. So there's at least, it's not very strong authority, but it's the only thing that I could find that at least addressed that issue that said that if a person actually encourages a driver, and in this case, Fontenot, who was a minor, and there was testimony in the record that showed that he would probably listen and would have listened to the only adult or his uncle, and he was just merely an extension of these passengers that were wanting to participate in a drag race with the uninsured motorist. And
now, the one that was doing the encouraging, was that Ms. Dabney?
Yes, sir.
And what was her percent of fault?
10.
Right.
And there's at least some authority in Texas to do that in a situation where there is a finding of the jury that person actually encouraged the violation of the law. And in this case, the petitioners have argued that, well, obviously we have racing, so we've got a violation of the law and a violation of the criminal statute, but the Dabney lady was found to have actually encouraged that action, and we have an affirmative jury issue on that. So I think that, and from the testimony, and from the record, I think the court...
That was actually the basis of the jury finding, was it not, of 10%.
That's right.
That'd be the only negligence she committed, would be racing and participating in that, right?
Well, no, sir, there were some other issues submitted. We were working under the assumption of some of the older cases that if you have a finding of a person realizing that a driver was intoxicated and going into the vehicle, or after you get in the vehicle realizing the person is intoxicated and having an opportunity to leave and doesn't. But then the court went on and submitted just kind of a barter plate issue on the percentages of all the people and of all the passengers, of all the parties, and there were two or three allegations of negligence as against her, and there's no way really to determine what percent, if they put that 10% on her participating in the race or encouraging the race, whether or not they found it on her staying in the vehicle with the intoxicated driver or buying the alcohol car.
I'm trying to figure out how this is going to work. Now, did you ask the trial court to submit an issue inquiring what the combined negligence of Fontenot, Dabney, and Passenger 2 and Passenger 3 was? Did you ask the court to join all of these?
Yes, I think if I understand your question, I asked the court, and I pled that the passengers' negligence or the driver's negligence ought to be imputed to the passengers because of the fact that they participated in this race, that they were intoxicated, and that they knew that the driver was intoxicated. I asked the court to do that, and based on the jury finding, I think it would be a simple matter. If I'm answering your question, I'm not sure that
I am. Yes, you are.
That all you would have to do is submit the case just under the standard jury pattern charge under the percentages, and then just combine them as to the cause of actions. As the damage cause of action and determining when the court takes the jury findings, all you would have to do is look at the percentages attributable to each of the parties and then combine them and then enter a judgment according to the, you know, to the opinion or to the law.
It would really be the imputation of negligence of all drunks inside automobile.
Yes, sir.
Each one would be imputed with the negligence of the other.
It would be the imputation of the drunk driver to the passengers that have been found to have knowledge that that person was intoxicated, or having once entered the vehicle, realized that that person was drunk and failed to remove himself when they had a reasonable opportunity to do it. I think what I would ask the court to do is that you have to have an affirmative jury finding that those facts existed, that one, the passenger perceived
that the driver was intoxicated, and that two, that once entering the vehicle, passenger realized that the driver was intoxicated and then had a reasonable opportunity to leave, but chose not to do so. I think with those affirmative finding, jury finding of those issues, then I think you could put the percentages just in the border plate, issue on the percentages, and then let the
court add them up.
Is that it? Let the court add them up?
Yes, sir.
Well, what do you do about a situation where the passenger gets in the automobile, he knows that the driver and he have both been drinking, and there are a couple of others, but he gets in the back seat and promptly goes to sleep before the car started? Are you going to say that he partially caused this wreck?
No, sir. I'm saying that when he brings a cause of action against a third party, that if you obtain a defendant, that third party, I'm not saying third party, but say the other vehicle, if that defendant obtains an affirmative jury finding that one, that passenger knew that the driver was intoxicated and then entered the car voluntarily, then I think that even though he went to sleep, it's all predicated on an affirmative finding that passenger knew that the driver was intoxicated and failed to remove himself. Now, take it one step further. Assume that the passenger gets in the vehicle and he goes to sleep. The driver hadn't been drinking at all, but during the course of a two-hour period, he's up in the front seat of a van, say, or these recreational vehicles, and he's up there drinking, and the passenger can prove that he had no knowledge that he was drinking, then I don't think that passenger should be precluded. I think it goes to an affirmative finding of knowledge on that passenger, that the passenger knew that driver. And I think that should be the distinguishing factor. Obviously, you shouldn't penalize a passenger who's in the back of a recreational vehicle, and the driver gets in and he's not drinking, and all of a sudden he's up there mixing himself scotch and waters, and then he has an accident. I don't think you ought to penalize the passenger in that case. But I think that if a passenger gets in that recreational vehicle or in that Chevrolet or that pickup truck, and he knows the driver, that the driver's been drinking and is probably intoxicated or is intoxicated, then if he goes to sleep, he's nevertheless been found to have that knowledge, and he had the choice or the opportunity to keep himself from that. And it only applies when that passenger is bringing a cause of action against another defendant, out in the public. And that's all I'm saying is that once you have to have an affirmative finding of knowledge of the passenger, and once you find it, once you obtain that jury finding, then what you're doing is you're imputing the negligence of that drunk driver predicated upon that knowledge. And that's what, and it's a limited circumstance like that, but it's predicated on affirmative finding of the jury that passenger had knowledge.
Well, suppose the jury finds that the passenger knew that the driver had the propensity to get drunk every time he went out on Saturday night and drove his van.
I don't think propensity would be sufficient. I would say you have to have actual knowledge.
I'm just trying to see how far you would extend
that. No, I wouldn't extend it past actual knowledge of that time. Propensity, should not be in evidence. All it should be is you saw him with a slurred speech, you knew he was drunk, you'd been at the bar with him at the honky tonk, and you'd been drinking, y'all had been there for 4 or 5 hours after work drinking. And you knew that. Yes, sir, I did know that. You got in that car even though you knew that. You knew that y'all had been asked to leave the club because he was intoxicated and falling out of his chair. In those circumstances, and I think that passenger should be precluded, or at least not precluded, totally precluded, because the courts have said they don't want to totally preclude them, but they ought at least combine the negligence of the passenger and the driver. And I think this would go a long way to this tremendous problem that we're having with drunk driving that's evident by newspaper articles and everything else all over the country.
Well, now, is that a question for the court? Is that a question for the legislature?
I think the court can go a long way to aiding the legislature and working hand in glove on that. I think that the court has an opportunity in cases of this sort, where we used to have a complete bar under circumstances like this. The courts have evidenced an intention to go to a comparative negligence type of situation in an effort to be fair and just. I'm saying that if the courts assume that, obviously I would like to have a total bar. But the courts have denied us that. I'm just saying that if you're going to take the total bar away from it, then I think you ought to at least combine the negligence of the driver and the passenger, because in that sense, the driver is an extension of the passenger. Just in the setting of intoxication. And that way, if you still want to use 2212A, what I'm suggesting is compatible to 2212A. You can use that. You can use 2212A. All you need to do is combine them for purposes of a, when you have an affirmative finding of the intoxication, what we've been talking about. And it would be compatible with 2212A, the sense of fairness. Obviously, if you want to, I would like to have a total bar, but that's been taken away from.
Would you do it in all cases where there was knowledge of drunkenness, or would you do it only in cases where there was evidence, which appears in this case to have been a situation where the injured passenger actually did something more affirmatively, namely encouraged by bringing the extra beer in the car?
I would do it, and I want to say this, I would do intoxication. I would do it in intoxication. In this case, it's even aggravated. Not only do you have a person that knows that boy, that minor boy is intoxicated, but you have an adult that's encouraging the very act that the petitioner's alleging caused the thing, racing. So in this case, it's even enlarged, it's even magnified. The drunkenness along with the participation, the actual encouraging of the act. And that's, I think this is even a stronger case to do what I'm suggesting. But I would limit it to intoxication. That's what I would suggest. I think this is even an aggravation of the situation. For the same reasons, I would suggest that even in Goolsbee and Hayes' case, that I think that it should be an imputing of the negligence of the driver as to those individuals separately.
If I understood you correctly, there's no findings of actual knowledge on behalf of those other two passengers.
Yes, sir, there is.
There is?
Yes. It's extended, it's aggravated, in Dabney, they not only found knowledge of intoxication, but they also found that she encouraged the racing and was participating in the race by actually leaning out the window, because there was testimony from the eyewitness that she was half out the window counting down. You know, she would get up there and there'd go one, like that, and the cars would speed off and then slow down. Then she'd lean out again and count it down and take off again. And she was the girl that was killed. She was the only female in the vehicle, and the eyewitness said that I saw a female leaning out the window counting down, and then after he came up to the scene of the wreck, she was the only female in the car and was on the side of the car, the driver's side, back part of the car. In conclusion, I think my brief speaks to the other issues that I brought up on cross points, and I appreciate the opportunity to be up here.
Thank you, counsel. Your response from the petitioner.
Peace Court. First, with reference to the application for writ of error in that point,
she was injured on the occasion in question. Testimony that she started out as a receptionist earning $1.31 an hour and had moved up the ladder and finally obtained the position of office manager, earning 9 years later $17,000, and was on her way up to obtain a regional manager's position. If I might digress a minute here, as I suggested to the Court of Appeals, is that Virginia was on her way up the ladder of success until she encountered an effective ladder, because according to the medical testimony, she will no longer be able to work. So there was ample in the medical testimony in terms of the medical bills. There was no contest. I admitted them in the evidence. There were no objections. There were no objections with respect to her lost earnings. And yet the jury nevertheless found a zero value. The courts have constantly held that the jury cannot ignore uncontradicted testimony. And when they find here in this instance that she was in fact injured as a result of the occasion in question, and yet nevertheless find that zero damages, I can only share with the court that the jury, having found no defect and having found no negligence, that is on part of the defendants, that their only reason for writing zero was, well, why should we give any money? Because no one is, the defendants are not responsible.
Counsel, before you leave that point, just tell me briefly, I haven't read the record, I admit, what the nature of her damages were, caused her to be prone. You said she didn't fall, did she?
She did not. She started to fall, and she grabbed on to the rungs, and her body snapped, and then eventually they brought her down. They took her to the hospital, and the doctor has done 2 laminectomies on her, and as he testified, that the results were not as she had wished them to be, and that as far as he's concerned, that she has reached maximum recovery with respect to the surgery, but that she will no longer be able to work. She's going to have to live with pain for the rest of her life. In terms of her monetary damages, I indicated earlier, she had lost wages at the time of the trial, about $30,000 or $40,000, and her projected loss earnings were in excess of $200,000, including the stock options that she was going to be entitled to. Like I said, she was up for promotion to reason.
Those elements were in the damages issue that the jury answered zero to?
Yeah, they answered zero to everything.
Did you try this in Dallas County?
I thought it was in Dallas County when I got the verdict there. So, in summary then, with respect to the second issue, it is our opinion then that the Court of Appeals correctly held, impliedly, that the jury or the jury's failure to find monetary damages was against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence. Brings me to the third, perhaps the more important issue, that the Court of Appeals impliedly correctly held that the principle of strict liability applies to architects. I'll preface my remarks by saying that in my judgment, the petitioner has not properly preserved its error. It was raised before the Court of Appeals simply in argument in support of their position of the harmless error rule. They did not raise it as an independent cross point. So I would submit that the petitioner has not properly preserved its error to bring it before this court. But notwithstanding my procedural position, substantively, I would submit to the court that the principle of strict liability does in fact apply to architects, particularly in this situation. The facts in this case reveal, as I've alluded to earlier in my opening statement, Abby Rentz employed Maurice Fleischman, said, we want you to build this building for us in San Antonio. Maurice had previously done 54 buildings on behalf of Abby Rentz. He was entirely in charge of the entire design of the building, including the particular access ladder that led to the roof. It was his blueprint that said, this ladder shall be so many feet high, we shall use this type of steel rung, and it shall be placed in this area. The blueprints and the specifications were given to the general contractor, who then gave it to the subcontractor, and he constantly was in San Antonio supervising the construction. When the building was completed, he went through the entire building, inspected it, and put his, as the saying goes, seal of approval, at which time then Abby Rentz then finally gave him his final payment. Testimony was that his fee was based on a percentage on the entire cost of the building. I think it was 9% of the entire cost of the building. So in this case, we have here, the petitioner would have the court that strict liability does not apply to architects. And I would pose these two questions to the court in response to the position taken by the petitioner. Are we saying to the plaintiff that had you used a portable ladder that had round steel rungs to climb the roof and slipped, which had been purchased from Sears, for example, that in that instance you would have a cause of action based on strict liability? However, you chose to use the ladder that was attached to the wall as distinguished from being portable. How in that instance, if your foot slips and fall and damage yourself, then strict liability will not apply. Is that what the petitioner wants us to
now,
believe?
In your case that you pose, if you go to Sears and buy a ladder, Sears is putting a product into the market. Now, my question, and I'm not predetermining it, I'm having a problem with it. An architect who tells a construction company how to construct something, He's not selling a ladder. He's not the one who puts it into the stream of traffic, of commerce. He's telling you, this is what it will look like when you do it. Now, help me with that.
I would say that the architect did, in fact, put that ladder in the stream of commerce. It was his blueprint, his written specifications given to the contractor. Said, this is the way I want this ladder on this area. He then, it was put that ladder in the stream of commerce, particularly so when after the whole building was completed and said, this thing was done according to the way I wanted it done, I put my stamp of approval on it, now building owner pay me my fee. In effect, what he did, he put that ladder in the stream of commerce.
Now, in the case of Ford Motor Company with their group of engineers who work for the company and who say this is the design for the carburetor, and this is the design for the brake, and this is the design for all of the other features, and all of that goes into the Ford car that is sold. Now, are those engineers, I'm trying to find out where we're going with this. If we say the architect in this case is liable in strict liability, are the engineers liable in strict liability in addition to Ford Motor Company?
If they're responsible for putting that particular product.
But you say responsible, now we're talking about negligence. We don't talk about conduct.
No, when I say responsible, I meant the wrong choice of words. If it was their idea and their concept that came about that gave birth, so to speak, to this particular product in the fashion of this particular design, then I would submit that, yes, that design engineer would be held strictly liable.
What are you doing with our definition? And it's the definition you submitted in this case. A defect. Is putting a commodity into the stream of commerce. Now, what do you do with that definition of defect? Are you saying that we've got to change the definition for the architect? He doesn't put it into the stream of commerce. He says, this is what I want it to look like when you put it into the stream of commerce.
I would say that indirectly or directly, he did in fact put that product in the stream of commerce. Particularly in this case, he was the one that said, that's the way I want it, I approve it. He said it was done according to his specification. Perhaps let me pose this question to the court. Are we saying to the general contractor who installed it that, yes, you will be strictly liable? However, architect, we're going to exonerate you from strict liability. And the contractor simply saying, but I did what I was told to do by the architect. And yet in one instance, the contractor, we're saying you will be held strictly liable, but on the other hand, we're saying to the architect, you will be exonerated from strict liability. I don't think that this is where this court wants to go with respect to these particular facts. And even if the law is not that architects are subject to strict liability, Justice Cardozo once said that wisdom is indeed a rare commodity. However, it should not be rejected because it's late in coming. And I would submit to this court that the wisdom of strict liability is, insofar as this particular case is concerned, that the concept should be extended to architects who, in this instance, actually put and assisted in the effective product in the stream of commerce. And then, but for his idea, and but for his instructions and specifications, this product would not have been in the stream of commerce. The fact that he has made it since 1941 and has designed that particular ladder hundreds and thousands of times is rather immaterial. And as the court knows, that the principle, the underlying principle of strict liability is on twofold. One is to impediment or as an encouragement to manufacturers or people who put defective products on the stream of commerce to tell them you better make a good product. Otherwise, you would be held strictly liable. A good case in point, obviously, everybody is aware, is a Pinto case. If the engineer way back in Detroit said, well, we're going to exonerate the engineer and therefore General Motors, the Ford Motor Company, we're going to exonerate you because that birth was given or that birth of an idea of a defective tank was given by some engineer, and I would submit that that is not where we want to go. In summary, Your Honor, with respect to the first issue, I think the trial court...
Before you summarize, let me ask you a question. How are we going to impose liability on an architect who furnishes services without extending that doctrine to doctors and lawyers who don't achieve the result for which they were hired?
I think you can draw a factual distinction between the two or but three types.
They're both furnishing services, even though one represents itself in a building and the other in a ream of papers or a bandage.
I think the distinction can be drawn in this fashion, Your Honor.
Tell me, please.
That an architect is more than just a professional providing services such as a doctor or a lawyer. His ideas then are given birth, and his ideas then are then put in concrete or cement, if I may. And his ideas then give birth to that product, which then goes into the stream of commerce with respect to a lawyer or respect to a doctor. The doctor is simply providing a medical service and tell him, I think you've got the flu in here, take a pill. Or I think you've got this and do that. A lawyer, you consult with a lawyer. You said, I think your legal problem is this, we should do this. There is no product involved. Whereas with an architect, there is a product, identifiable product involved.
The lawyer gives a divorce decree to his clients or gives a contract to his clients. That's a product.
I think it's a product.
I'm really having trouble with this distinction, counsel. I'm searching for an answer now, and this is not a frivolous question.
I understand. I think it's in a strict technical sense, yes, it's a product. But I think it's a different type of product for the one we're talking about here. When an architect's involved, you're talking about a tangible product that could cause injury, buildings, ladders, anything that an architect does. Whereas with a lawyer, I seriously doubt that with a divorce decree, even though it is a product, it may be damaging to the losing party, an injury, causing an injury to the losing party, but I don't think it was a physical injury that could be caused. And I think there's where the distinction can be drawn.
Aren't they all furnishing services, though, even though there may be some tangible outcome?
It's a hybrid.
Like the bridge in one's mouth from the dentist, or the contract that the lawyer prepares, or something the doctor does for you, like an artificial heart?
Or a nose spray. It's just the gas. It's gone.
That's
whiff, and it's gone.
I think that this is, I lost my fucking
services. Well, my question was, you know, this is services, isn't it, rather than products?
Well, I started to say it was a hybrid situation where you have a service product involved. And when you have that hybrid situation, then I think you have to look at the fact situation involved, such as in this case we have an ultimate product, i.e. the ladder. So I think when you got that hybrid situation, whether it's fish or fowl, then you've got to look at the facts in determining whether or not you're going to extend the principle of strict liability to that particular profession.
Is there any difference that you may have an economic loss resulting from a lawyer's bad design of a will as distinguished from a physical injury due to a design defect?
I think so. I forgot the style of the case, nobility, where you strict liability concept was entered into, and I think you limited there to, I think, with an economic loss issue involved, and I think you held the strict liability, as I remember, it did not apply in that time of this. He's talking about only economic losses as distinguished from physical injuries and losses resulting therefrom. Yes, I will draw that distinction. Your Honor, see my red light is on. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
In one sentence, I simply will say that respectfully pray that the judgment of the Court of Appeals be in all things affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear rebuttal from the petitioner.
Briefly on the question of the jury instruction, the out-of-state cases that the respondent says support his position are distinguishable. I don't think I talked much about him in my application, but I did distinguish him in my Appellee's brief in the Court of Appeals. Basically, the out-of-state decisions involved general charges, and I remember at least one of them involved a general charge where there was a contributory negligence part of the general charge just kind of floating around there, not tied to any one other question, which is completely different.
We just have three copies of the appellee's brief that they all got here. And there's nine of us, so if you don't put it in the response or in your application, we don't see it.
Yes, sir. Will you take my word for it?
Well, some of us may forget, even if you tell us about it, counsel, because we consider 25 cases in the course of a week, and if you've got something to say that's in your athlete's brief, I would suggest you file some additional copies.
I'd be glad to, and I will do so.
Not that I didn't hear you say it.
All right. But they are distinguishable in that sense, and I'd be glad to submit a letter brief to the court pointing that out. In response to the strict liability of an architect problem, one thing I might point out is that here, I think the consumer of this design was Abby Rentz. It's in the record that Abby Rentz was who went and hired Mr. Fleischman to do these designs. I think this takes it out of the situation, or at least is one way of distinguishing the distributive chain that some concern has been expressed about, where there's a designer who works for GM, who manufactures cars, who then puts them in commerce to the consuming public. Abby Rentz here is, I think, the consumer we should talk about, and I think in realizing that, we realize that Abby Rentz went to Fleischman and sought from Fleischman, like any person seeks from any professional, its judgment and skill and confidence, and that it would be a very revolutionary thing to hold that this professional service provider is somehow insurer of whatever he's asked to do.
Ms. Livingston, doesn't an architect, though, traditionally provide more than a mere service? Don't architects get out on the job site and supervise the construction and make certain that the construction follows the plans?
I don't know that we can say that they always do. I know in this case...
Didn't they in this case, though?
In this case, I have read the record, and I don't remember anything about Mr. Fleischman being in San Antonio supervising this job. Maybe...
Mr. Herrera said so in his...
I know he did, and what I'll do is I'll look for that, and in my letter brief, I'll clarify that factual issue, too. Your Honor, I'm just not sure what the record shows on that. I don't remember seeing...
Well, all of the discussion up to now has been on the assumption that an architect provides merely a service and therefore should not be strictly liable.
I think I see what you're asking. And if he went to the site and supervised, I think the question would be whether he negligently supervised.
But isn't he assisting putting a product into the stream of commerce if he's there supervising the construction of that product?
Your Honor, I don't believe so. I believe that what he's doing is a service. Even in assisting in the construction, he's being asked to render his services.
Well, that really probably wouldn't make any difference at all, because he had designed it, and if he were there, it would have come out the same ladder, wouldn't it?
I suppose it would. Somebody else makes that decision that his service and his design is going to become a product. As I said earlier, it's the manufacturer makes that decision. He just renders a service, and I don't think that design on a piece of paper is going to hurt anybody.
I don't know if it's in the record, but was the ladder fabricated on the spot by workmen?
No.
Or did they have to go to a foundry or some, or a machine shop or something to have a ladder made?
It was fabricated by one of the initially named defendants, Jackson Steel Company. And then it was installed by the general contractor in the building.
I want to cite to you a leading case. This is in my brief on this designer question, and it's pretty good. Talks a lot about policy. It's La Rosa versus Scientific Design Company, 402 F. 2nd, 937 by the Third Circuit. In that case, an engineering company designed a chemical plant.
Is that a federal case?
Yes, sir. It's the Third Circuit.
What's the page, 402 Fed Second?
402 Fed Second 937. The court refused to include engineering services within strict liability, and it reasoned that professional services just simply lacked the elements that gave rise in the first place to the doctrine of strict liability. And some of these elements that it pointed out as not being applicable are that the reasons for strict liability was that there was a lack of privity between a remote consumer and a manufacturer, that it was maybe difficult to prove negligence against a distant manufacturer, and that a manufacturer is better able to spread the economic risks. And it said in the case of a professional service provider, these considerations just don't justify, or just aren't there, and therefore strict liability is not justified. In answer to Judge Spears' question about whether you can ever distinguish an architect from a doctor or a lawyer, I don't think you can. And it is true that a lawyer may not have problems with personal injuries, but a doctor certainly does. And so I don't think the fact that whether economic losses or personal injuries are involved is going to be a valid distinction or one that we can use. Briefly, our error was preserved. I don't think it was necessary to have a cross point in our brief. We, of course, raised the non-liability issue of an architect at trial in our, I think, a motion for instructive verdict, and then a motion after the verdict. We included the argument as a reply point to show no harmful error, and I don't think it was necessary for us to do more than argue a reply point. In any event, I don't think it matters because I've got a couple of cases. I think one of them, it's been a long time, but I think Cheshire versus First State Bank, decided by this court, talked about the difference between reply points and cross points, and I believe the effect of the decision to be that as long as the argument is there, the court's not going to make a technical distinction between the labels on the points. With regard to damages, the position I want to make clear is that there was some evidence of damage from other causes, so the jury's finding is not as outlandish as it may seem at first. And in any event, in order for the court to even reach that question, it's going to have to decide that the Court of Appeals erred in denying leave to file the supplemental brief, and only then can the damage question even be before this court. And I think it's questionable whether it may not have to go back to the civil appeals for them to pass on damages. So I don't know what would come of that, but wanted to point that out. Are there any further questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel, you suggested you want to file a letter brief. How much time do you need for that?
Oh, 10 days.
10 days. And counsel, how much time would you like to have to respond? It'll be granted to both of you.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument for the day, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
The audience, please rise. Oh yes, oh yes, oh yes. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.